Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of On The Case. Today, we're delighted to have Simon Clark, an ex-Wall Street Journal financial journalist, specializing in private equity and other stories in the world of finance, business, and politics. He was also a Pulitzer Prize nominee in 2016 for his part in the team that exposed the 1MDB financial scandal in Malaysia. Finally, he's the co-author of The Key Man, published in 2021, about the rise and fall of the Abraj Group, once the largest emerging markets private equity firm, which was also a pioneer proponent of impact investing. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Thank you, Andrew.
So this episode is really to provide an understanding of this particular cautionary tale in a simple way for our listeners, how it affects everyday people like us and its implications on private equity regulation and the future of impact investing. So firstly, can you tell us more about Arif Naqvi, his background, his personality, his beliefs?
Arif Naqvi is a graduate of the London School of Economics. He grew up in Pakistan and then came to London to study at LSE. And then in the early 80s, he worked at various financial firms. He was an accountant for a time at Arthur Andersen. Then he worked for a billionaire in Saudi Arabia at the Alayan Group. Before, in 1994, moving to Dubai, where he started his first investment firm. He founded Abraj in Dubai in 2001-2002 as the first private equity firm really focusing on buying companies in the Middle East. Before Abraj, there were a lot of private equity firms which would go to the Middle East to raise money, which they would then use to buy companies in Europe and North America. But Abraj focused on investing, buying companies based in the Middle East.
For the benefit of our listeners, can you provide a brief explanation of, you know, what private equity and what impact investing mean?
Sure. So a private equity firm buys a company and then tries to improve its performance, either by increasing sales or profitability, cutting costs. They can sometimes do that by trying to reduce the workforce or asset stripping, as their critics say. They equally can try and improve performance by investing, expanding the geographical reach of the company, improving performances. And then they try and sell that company within 5 years for a multiple of what they paid for it. So it's a very profit-driven area of finance. They often use borrowed money to fund their acquisitions, and the borrowings are secured on the companies they buy. So they're not taking it onto their own balance sheets. They're taking the debt onto the balance sheets of the companies that they're acquiring.
This is called the leverage buyout, is it?
That's correct. And Abraj, as I said, was a pioneer of this in the Middle East. Its first acquisition in 2002 was of a company called Aramex, which is a parcel and letter delivery company. It's sometimes called the FedEx of the Middle East. When Abraj acquired it, Aramex was trading on the Nasdaq Stock Exchange. And because of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, the value of the shares of Aramex had plummeted. And so the company was cheap. Abraj's founders recognized this was an opportunity to buy this company, which had become cheaper, but whose performance and purpose was still very much required. You know, there was still a need to deliver parcels and letters across the Middle East. And so they bought this company, delisted it from the Nasdaq Stock Exchange, took it private, and they did invest in expanding its operations, rebasing it in Dubai, buying other parcel companies in countries like Egypt. And then they IPO'd it in the United Arab Emirates. They sold shares in the company again in the UAE in 2005, I think it was. And they made a multiple of the amount that they had invested in the company. It was a successful investment. And the company benefited from Abraj's period of ownership in that instance. It expanded. It was more successful at the end of Abraj's period of ownership than it was before. So that was a success.
This was an example of impact investing, right?
So impact investing is a term which has emerged after Abraj acquired Aramex. It's a bit of a vague term. But basically, impact investors say that they can make profit for their investors at the same time as producing a social or environmental positive outcome. They may say that they are doing that by, let's say, in the environmental space, if they are investing in a renewable energy, which is replacing a fossil fuel energy, they would say that they're producing positive impact by reducing carbon dioxide emissions. if it's in a social space, if they invest in a low-cost healthcare company that provides healthcare services to people that didn't previously have healthcare, then the impact investor might be able to say that they're producing positive social impact by providing healthcare services that did not previously exist. Now, there is a tension in impact investing because the claim that the investor can make profit at the same time as producing a positive social environmental outcome, that may be true. It also may not be true. It may just be marketing. Or in the worst case scenario, it might be outright fraud.
I see. Thank you for the explanation of private equity and impact investing. Let's go back to that question on what is Abraaj Group and who are some of its early investors?
So Abraaj Group started out as a private equity firm in the Middle East, and it did have some successful early investments, as we've discussed. It expanded across Africa and Southern Asia and Latin America. In 2012, it bought another private equity firm called Orios, which had initially been set up by the British and Norwegian governments to invest in small and medium-sized companies in developing countries. And Orios's investors included a lot of so-called development finance institutions, which are government-owned funds which seek to invest in developing countries through private equity funds to increase services and jobs. Now, by acquiring Orios, Abraaj effectively acquired relationships with all of Orios's investors. So that included CDC, which is owned by the UK government, OPIC, which is owned by the US government, Proparco, which is owned by the French government. And another big investor in Orios was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So this is the philanthropic foundation of Bill Gates, the billionaire founder of Microsoft. So as Abraaj expanded geographically, it also was an early mover in claiming that it was an impact investor. It was helped in this claim by the fact that many of the countries it invests in are so-called developing countries or emerging markets, where populations are living on much lower annual incomes than, say, in the United Kingdom or the United States, so countries like Kenya or Pakistan. So because Abraaj was buying companies in these countries, it was also saying that, look, we can make profits in these countries and we can also help end poverty in these countries by providing services and building companies that could create jobs. That enabled it to market its services to Western investors who were seeking profits, like banks and pension funds, but also to these so-called development finance institutions, which needed to be able to claim not only that they were making money, but that they were doing good by helping countries develop. Abraaj could also market itself to foundations, philanthropic foundations like the Gates Foundations, because of this pitch that it was making. And so it evolved from being a plain private equity firm to being a private equity firm which claimed that it was a significant impact investor by dint of its position between the developed worlds and the developing world. The firm was saying effectively to the world, you know, we can raise money from countries which are rich and invest it in countries which are poor and help those countries become rich. And that's why, one of the reasons why, you know, the book is called The Key Man, that the founder of Abraaj, the LSE graduate Arif Naqvi, positioned himself as a key man in the global economy.
I see. How much was Arif Naqvi instrumental to this, to the success of the Abraaj Group? What about his personality was so striking?
So Arif is a very charismatic, very intelligent person. He has a very wide network, which he developed over time. He was a regular attendee at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos in Switzerland. He was on the board of the UN Global Compact, which advises the UN Secretary General on the Sustainable Development Goals. He was on the board of the Interpol Foundation, which was supposed to raise money for the global police agency Interpol. And he's a very convincing public speaker. He obviously convinced a lot of people who have a lot of money that he was able to fulfill the mission that he said Abraaj was on, which was a mission of making profitable investments, which made the world a better place. The trouble is that in early 2018, with colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, we received evidence that there was a serious problem at Abraaj, that money was being mismanaged. And throughout 2018, we were publishing articles about the scale of this problem at Abraaj. And in 2019, after our journalism was published, the US Department of Justice criminally indicted Arif and five of his colleagues, accusing them of fraud and theft and attempted bribery. And Arif faces 291 years in jail if found guilty of all these charges. He maintains his innocence. He's currently under house arrest, effectively, he's living on bail in London, in South Kensington. and two of his colleagues have pleaded guilty. The Dubai Financial Services Authority, which was supposed to be the principal regulator of Abraj, has fined the firm $315 million. It's also fined Arif about $163 million. He's appealing that. He's also appealing the UK government's decision to extradite him to the United States to face trial. So it's all ended rather badly for Abraj, because a lot of the promises which it was making do not appear to have been fulfilled.
Yeah. And I think that's a good segue into our next part, which is his fall from grace, right? So let's go into a bit more detail about, you know, what triggered your investigation.
Well, the first thing that triggered it was an email which was sent to my co-author, Will Louch, in January 2018 from someone who wouldn't give their name, who said they were an employee of Abraj. And this person was saying that there was a serious problem at the firm, including $200 million from Abraj's $1 billion healthcare fund had gone missing. Now, the investors in this fund included the Gates Foundation and these funds belonging to the UK, US and French governments and the World Bank. Now, because this person wouldn't give us their name, we didn't know who they were or what their motive was, so we couldn't use that email exchange to write an article, but we could use the information they were giving us to go and talk to other people and try and verify it. And that's what we did. We spoke to dozens and then hundreds of people, ultimately, within Abraj, at investors in Abraj and elsewhere. We were able to verify that initial piece of information and publish the first article in February 2018 about this allegedly missing money being investigated by investors. And then we ended up spending most of the rest of the year writing about Abraj too. By the middle of the year, a chain of sources, you know, I'd interviewed Arif years before in Dubai and knew people in the firm. A chain of sources had put me in contact with someone who had documentary evidence showing alleged fraud and theft at Abraj. And this person, I was able to meet them. I know who this person is. I know how they had the information. So I knew that these documents were authentic. And we were able to use these documents and other evidence to show what had been going on at Abraj, which was that hundreds of millions of dollars of investment funds, which were supposed to be invested in companies, were being siphoned out of the Abraj funds into sort of secret bank accounts. And then Abraj was using this money to spend to keep the firm afloat on salaries, expenses. Money was being sent to Arif Naqvi's bank accounts in the Cayman Islands and other companies he had in tax havens around the world. And this wasn't supposed to be happening.
I'm just wondering, right, how could the embezzlement of funds by Arif have gone on for so long without anyone noticing? Some investors weren't paid for months on end or even years. Was it just sheer confidence in the personality of Arif?
Partly it was that. And partly there's a lot of secrecy in private equity. So private equity funds are not publicly traded. And investors in those funds, well, it turns out, in some instances, don't know what's going on within those funds. I mean, that's the conclusion that we can draw from the Abraj saga. Yes, they really should know what's going on in these funds. In this case, they did not.
That's quite scary, actually, because a lot of these investors are state-owned taxpayer money.
Yeah, so the development finance institutions are investing your and my money, you know, as citizens of the United Kingdom or United States. Also, pension funds, public pension funds in the United States were major investors in Abraj. So nurses, police officers, teachers were investing in Abraj through their pension funds.
Were they sleeping on the job or like what?
Well, there are a lot of people who clearly should have known what was going on, but didn't. So Abraj was audited by KPMG. KPMG in the UAE is being sued by Abraj's liquidators and investors. You know, before we received the whistleblower email a few months before in September 2017, investors in a $6 billion fund that Abraj was raising also received an email whistleblower tip-off saying, don't believe anything Abraj tells you. They're misusing money. They are overvaluing their investments. This is a big problem.
Yeah.
We know that that email went to one major US private equity investor, which was channeling public funds into Abraj, a firm called Hamilton Lane. And we know that Hamilton Lane did ask Abraj about this email, like, you know, what's going on? And they were given a very indignant response from the founder of Abraj along the lines of course, we're not doing what this person says. How dare you even ask? It's offensive to think that you think we're doing this. And then as far as we can see, there was no change. There was no recommendation from the investors to stop investing in Abraj as a result of that email.
And they even misled some investors as well because they gave falsified bank transfer receipts, right?
Yeah. In late 2017, Abraj, as I mentioned, had a $1 billion healthcare fund, which it was supposed to use to buy and expand hospitals and clinics in Africa and Southern Asia. It kept asking investors to send money to this fund, but it didn't seem to be investing that money in hospitals. So one investor, a guy called Andrew Farnham, who at the time worked at the Gates Foundation, wanted to know where the money was going. And so he called up Abraj and said, where's this $200 million that you've asked us for, but don't seem to have invested? And Abraj was very reluctant to answer him, which is I've always found amazing. I mean, if you ring up your bank and ask them where your money is and they tell you they're not going to tell you, I mean, you consider that to be unreasonable. Equally, you know, if you give a couple of $100 million to a private equity firm and you ask where it is, I think they should tell you where it is.
Is that illegal, though, if they don't tell you?
I mean, I'm very careful to say what is legal and illegal. I'll stick to what the facts that I know. So what I know is that Andrew Farnham said, where's the money? Eventually, Abraj told him it's in a bank account at the Commercial Bank of Dubai. And then 2 months later, he was on a conference call with the Abraj again, and he asked them again, hey, where's that money? And this time they said it's in Standard Bank in the Cayman Islands, to which he responded, what do you mean it's in Standard Bank in the Cayman Islands? You told me it was in the Commercial Bank of Dubai. So which one is it? And on this conference call, he was told, okay, we'll get back to you. At which point he's really quite scared and worried, because if a money management firm doesn't know where the money is, then you've got a problem. At that point, he tried to communicate his concerns to other investors in the fund, to tell them, hey, they previously told me this money was in the Commercial Bank of Dubai, and now they're telling us it's in Standard Bank. He tried to communicate that through a group email, which Abraj had set up for its investors. But he sent the email and it bounced back. Turns out it bounced back because Abraj had disabled the group email to try and stop investors from talking to each other. Anyway, he found other ways to talk to investors and they started investigating. Now, again, interestingly, after he was asking these questions to Abraj, the founder of Abraj tried a tactic which he'd used on other occasions, which is if a mid-level person at an investment firm asked too many questions, he would ring up a senior executive at the investment firm and say, look, your junior is causing us a problem, asking us difficult questions. This is really offensive, quite insulting. Now, in at least two other instances where Arif tried this, he got senior executives to apologize to him. They say, I'm very sorry for the embarrassment caused. But when Arif tried this at the Gates Foundation, the senior executive called Andrew Farnham into a room and said, look, what's going on at Abraj? Andrew said, I think it's us who should be offended here. I'm just asking a very straightforward question. Where's the money? And if that's causing them a problem, then we probably have a problem. And in this instance, the senior executive for the Gates Foundation said to Andrew Farnham, okay, continue with your investigation. And because the senior executive backed the more junior executive, that really was a turning point at the Abraj story. It gave the exec at the Gates Foundation the authority and the backing to continue with his investigation.
And one thing that I want to point out is also the incident where Arif arranged a meeting with the owner of the Wall Street Journal as well to try and stop you and Will Lauch from reporting on this, right?
Yeah, it wasn't with the owner. It was with the chief executive and the European editor. And it was at the World Economic Forum in Davos in January 2018. He met with these executive and the editor. And we don't know exactly what happened, but people who were present in the meeting said that he was saying, look, we've got a problem with your reporters. Anything you can do about it. Unfortunately, that meeting didn't result in us being pulled off the story.
He seems like an entitled man, like he's entitled to all these privileges.
Well, I think that's what can happen if you spend a lot of time talking to other rich and powerful people. There is a risk in these sort of networking circles, which bring the very wealthy and the powerful together, that they become overly familiar with each other and increasingly disconnected from the majority of humanity who are not billionaires or presidents or prime ministers. And this is a troubling aspect of our world, I think.
And I think it's also a warning for impact investing within the private sector, because at the end of the day, if you're giving all this money to private equity firms who are owned by rich and very powerful and very connected people, there is this inherent disconnect that cannot be resolved easily.
I completely agree with you. If impact investors and the impact investing movement is going to deliver on its promise of ending poverty, then poor people have to be involved in that process. Otherwise, I don't see how they can ever deliver on their promise. And this is one obvious and very troubling aspect of the key man story, which is that we have multimillionaires shaping an increasingly explicit message over years saying, hey, give us your millions. We'll go and invest them and end poverty. And there's not a poor person in sight. how can you help people who live on a few dollars a day if you're not talking to them? I mean, it's obvious that they need to be involved. And if this is a cautionary tale about what happens when they're not involved, then I really hope people are going to read The Key Man and learn how such an extraordinary disconnect can be possible between what a person says and what they do. Because while this may be an extreme case, I don't think it's a unique case.
Can you qualify that statement? What do you mean by that?
Well, so we have a chapter in the book about the development of the impact investing movement. And it's been going on for years, but it became increasingly explicit and formed from like 2007, 2008 onwards. And there was an important meeting where a group of social investors, ethical investors, triple bottom line capitalists, they had sort of had different names for what they did.
What is a triple bottom line capitalist?
Triple bottom line is a movement of investors who say that they're investing for people, planet, profit. Right. And they met at a villa on a lake in northern Italy, which is owned by the Rockefeller Foundation. And the beginning of that chapter starts with the following line. The meeting to end poverty started with cocktails before dinner. And again, that is literally true. There were cocktails before dinner and they were trying to end poverty, but there were no poor people in the room. And now, you know, with modern technology, we have the ability to have global conversations that include people across socioeconomic strata. And I think we should be trying really hard to do that. And we're not. Often, you know, as a financial journalist, I've been to like hundreds of conferences. And usually, you know, the people who have the chance to speak and come together are very wealthy and very powerful. And that's fair enough most of the time. But if you're going to have a conference about ending poverty, then poor people should participate. I mean, there's a line in the epilogue of the book where I say that, you know, to have a conference about the global economy or about ending poverty where there are no poor people present, that has about as much integrity as a conference of men talking about gender equality.
Yeah.
We now recognize that's ridiculous, but we haven't got to a place where we recognize that having global conversations about poverty or development, where everyone in the room is, you know, globally well off, is ridiculous. And obviously, we are globally amongst the fortunate. Yeah. You know, anyone who gets to LSE, as you have, and I did, I was also a master's student at LSE, we become part of a global community of educated people with opportunities. And that's great, unless we end up in a bubble of similar people who increasingly become disconnected from the rest of humanity. That's not great. So I think the challenge for us LSE graduates or graduates from any other university, if we're interested in the economy and social issues, is to find ways to maintain a genuine connection to people who have not gone to the LSE, who are still back in our hometowns or home countries living on a few dollars a day. It's really challenging. And I think it's a conversation that we should be having more often. But I don't really hear people having that conversation.
Yeah, well said. I totally support everything that you said about bringing in the people that actually have a stake in the decisions that these people are making. Just one more point about impact investing, which I'm curious about. Despite such a recent scandal, impact investing is still a buzzword in business today. Personally, I'm quite attracted to its appeal, especially within the private sector, which has the potential to allocate large amounts of capital efficiently and effectively without all the red tape of government. And if we take a step back, the Abraj Group did manage a few successful ventures here and there, such as the successful IPO of Aramex that you mentioned just now, which benefited everyday workers of the company. But what are your thoughts on really this effectiveness of impact investing in the private sector? Would you rather move impact investing within the public domain, which is much more regulated and much more transparent?
Well, you say private capital can be invested efficiently and effectively, and that is true. But it can also be invested inefficiently and ineffectively. So the question is, how do we increase the effectiveness and efficiency of investing private capital in a way that genuinely brings about positive social and environmental outcomes? And that is not an endeavor to be left to the private sector. That is an endeavor which requires private capital and private capital investors, but also public institutions such as regulators and politicians who are shaping policy around capital markets. And it also requires the active involvement of citizens, of people who are taking an active interest in what the private investors are doing. So it's easy to allow a simplistic narrative to evolve where we talk about, oh, let's just leave it to the private sector, or let's just leave it to the public sector, in which we create a false dichotomy where we're sort of given a choice of, do you believe that the private sector can help lead humanity to a better future, or do you believe we should leave it all to the public sector? When the answer is neither and both. We need the private sector and we need the public sector, and we need them to have the right relationship. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the answer is public-private partnerships, because some of those public-private partnerships can be disastrous too.
I see.
So in each situation, you know, are we building a healthcare policy for Kenya, or are we talking about the best way to create electricity for Karachi, right? There are specific circumstances where there is a need for effective public policy and regulation, and there is a need for private capital to be invested in energy sector in Pakistan, or perhaps in the healthcare sector in Kenya. But we need to have a transparent conversation about what is the best way to go about this. And if private sector investors are telling us, leave it to us, don't worry about it, I would strongly encourage citizens to not accept that. We should all be actively involved and interested, engaged in what is going on. Equally, you know, these challenges cannot just be left to governments, right? There is a need for private capital, for capital markets to play an active role in creating companies, providing services, but they need to be regulated, and they need to be regulated effectively. So it's not a question about choosing between public or private. It's a question about the right relationship between public and private, and citizens and investors having access to enough information to decide what is the right course of action here. Then if something goes wrong, we're able to see why it went wrong. It doesn't, the situations, investments are going to go wrong, even if there's no fraud or mismanagement. You know, things don't always go to plan, but at least we'll be able to see and understand why a situation went wrong and fix it or learn from it. The trouble is, in private equity and impact investing, often is that there is not enough transparency. There's a lot of secrecy. Funds are structured in tax havens. They don't disclose enough public information. So we can't really see what's going on.
I want to talk about the scandal's implications on regulation. You mentioned that private equity regulation is few and far between, right? It's quite opaque. So what's the current landscape like? And what kind of laws do you think should be passed that could steer private equity into a more transparent future?
So in private equity, there is a lot of secrecy. And I think there's more secrecy than the firms deserve. They usually or often structure their funds in offshore financial centers, which are also known as tax havens. And there are some good reasons to do that, but there are also perhaps some not so good reasons to do that. It makes the funds harder to understand, more secretive, less transparent, and particularly where those funds are managing government money, I don't really see why they should have the right to be so secretive. So I do think there's an issue around the transparency of private equity funds in general and their use of tax havens to structure those funds. I think that's problematic. I think it's shown to have been problematic in the Abrage story. Their regulation is improving. The US SEC regulator has just put out new disclosure requirements for private equity funds, which is a positive step. I think within the impact investing world, there's not a clear definition of what impact investing is. And so the term has continued to flourish, even as it perhaps becomes more confusing to define it. So the biggest US private equity firms many of them have started impact funds, and they are defining impact in various ways. This is a broader problem in the sort of ethical finance.
It's a bit like greenwashing. We can exactly. Call it impact washing.
ESG has this problem. The whole environmental social governance movement has sort of been a victim of its own success, where demand for environmental, social, governance positive funds has spurred asset managers to rebrand their existing products as ESG products when they're not really doing perhaps anything positive in an ESG sense. So there is a need for more stringent regulation around defining ESG and impact investing. And that is happening. You know, the European Union, the SEC is working on legislation to define these terms.
I see. That's encouraging.
Yeah.
I want to zero in on one specific point that you made about the tax havens. In the book, you mentioned that, you know, limited partnerships are able to avoid taxes and regulatory oversight through complex structures where they are based in tax havens like the Cayman Islands. So for instance, within the Abraj Group scandal, you mentioned before that one part is based in Dubai, another part is based in the Cayman Islands. And then so the Dubai Financial Services Authority thought that it was another jurisdiction's issues. And then that jurisdiction thought that it was a Dubai's jurisdiction. So it ended up being no one checking on the Abraj Group. So how can governments prevent such things from happening?
Well, that was a good explanation you gave of the situation. I guess if regulators did their jobs better, that would help. I mean, if the regulators checked on where the various bits of Abraj were based and who was responsible for them, that would have been helpful. Yeah, it's not just a question of having the right rules. It's also a question of then enforcing those rules. And that is not always easy because there are lots of funds out there and not so many regulators. And also financial scandals happen, then regulators sort of become more attentive to those problems. Those problems don't happen, but then new problems happen. I mean, it seems to be the way that finance progresses. So for me, like the genuinely most helpful suggestion I can make here is that more people take an interest in how global finance works. And when they hear financial firms and individuals making big claims about how finance is going to make the world a better place, it's wise to politely inquire about how financial firms are going to do that exactly and not to accept the first answer that is given. I mean, if finance and financial firms are increasingly going to say to humanity that they've got the answers, then it's reasonable that all of us citizens of the world politely inquire how that is, they're going to go about that. And by the way, what are the terms of their compensation from doing this? Because often in finance, increasingly, firms are talking about how they can produce positive outcomes. They may not be talking about the 20% of profits that they're going to keep from doing that. And maybe that's the right thing to do in some instances. And in other instances, maybe it's not. We just need to take more of an interest in what financial firms are doing. Yes, finance can help solve amazing problems. Sometimes financial firms can cause amazing problems too.
And when they cause amazing problems, I think we're all left to suffer for it.
Right? Yeah,
and I think my last question is really on, you know, how does this affect everyday people like us? Why should the average person on the street care about this? Other than the fact that, you know, your money is in pension funds, your money is taxpayers' money. Why else should the average person on the street care about all these people in their ivory towers in the private sector?
Because money plays a very big role in making our world go round as a global society. We have a global financial system. It can play a positive role in helping humanity, absolutely. Equally, the global financial system can be used to exploit humanity. You know, here's a choice. Which is it going to be? Is the global financial system going to help humanity or is it going to exploit humanity? That's why we should all take an interest in how exactly the global financial system works. We have a global financial system, whether we want to have one or not. The question is, what is it going to do? The more people that take an interest in how it works, the more confident I will feel that it might play a positive role. The less people that are taking an active interest in how the global financial system works, the more I'm going to worry about it being used, for example, by oligarchs to hide billions of dollars or rubles or euros or other currencies, which they may or may not have a right to have, and then hide that money. Or you know, the global financial system may be used by funds which are raised from governments and pension funds on a claim that those funds are going to be used to invest in developing countries to help bring about development, reduce suffering, reduce sickness, reduce poverty. And then perhaps those funds are instead siphoned off. That's not a good outcome for humanity. It's not a good outcome for the financial system either. And this is why it's a really important public policy question, a really important ethical question, a really important civic question for us all to find out what is going on exactly within the global financial system. This is something which we should all be interested in, whether we want to become bankers or not. It is an important question for bankers and private equity executives. It's also an important question for everyone else in the world.
Perfect. I think that's all the questions from me. But before we end this episode, I'd like to just give a shout out to all our listeners. If you're interested to understand more about this story, the exciting details, the email chains, then I highly recommend you to buy Simon's book, The Key Man. Despite not having much knowledge on these finance terms, I still thoroughly enjoyed this book. And I know that our listeners will as well. So once again, Simon, thank you for this insightful discussion. And I think I speak for all our listeners when I also say thank you for your efforts in investigating complex white-collar crime and injustice that is done in our society today.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you for your interest and your understanding.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time!